The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The Commerce Department reports retail sales jumped 3.8% in January. That's up 13% from the same time last year.
We have to read between the lines a little bit. The data is not inflation adjusted. So some of the increases are just because things cost more. Gas sales were up 33% year over year, which sounds like a lot, but gas prices are up 40% year over year. So that actually suggests that people bought a little bit less gas. They were just paying a lot more per gallon. So when people are paying more for gas and they're paying more for groceries and they're paying more for housing, there's less left over for other things. Or they have to go into debt. According to the New York Fed, credit card balances rose more in the fourth quarter than any other quarter on record in this 22-year data set.
Breaking news yesterday, the Ukrainian government reported the largest cyber attack in the nation's history. Both Ukraine's defense ministry, army, and the country's two largest banks were breached.
There's a lot of scientists telling us what could happen under different circumstances, but there's a lot of politicians that like to basically say, look, we should just follow the science, and you know, you capitalize all those words. But of course, science doesn't tell you how to prioritize between different things. You know, take another example that's very obvious and straightforward. Every year, more than a million people around the planet die from traffic accidents. These are all man-made. We know how to avoid them. You just set the speed limit at 3 miles an hour and nobody dies. But of course, we don't actually make that decision. We don't just say, all right, so you got to slow down and go 3 miles an hour. And then basically you're going to give up your entire economy. You can't do anything. You can't certainly have a continentally integrated economy, but you can't even get to your friends or family. But we make a political decision of should we have, you know, 55 miles an hour or should we have 65 or 75 miles an hour. That is the political conversation. That's a trade-off between being able to move relatively fast and saving more people. That's a reasonable conversation to have, but that's not about following the science. It's about asking science, what will be the impact of 55 miles an hour? What will be the impact of 75 miles an hour? And then making a political decision. It's the very same thing we've been doing, or what we should be doing under Corona. We ask the experts, what will happen if we shut down? What will happen if we don't shut down? And then we make a decision somewhere in between where we weigh off the costs and the benefits.
We have a population now where more than 90% of the population has some form of immunity, either through vaccination, infection, or both. Most of the people who've chosen to go unvaccinated are not that concerned about COVID and don't want to be subjected to the measures. With that much immunity in the population, not just a lot broad immunity, but deep immunity, many people have been both vaccinated and infected. We need to lean forward and start relaxing some of the measures as vigorously as we put them in place. Now, they will announce some new guidance next week on mask recommendations in particular, tying risk to local measures of prevalence and hospitalizations and not just cases. I think that that's an appropriate adjustment, that we start looking at the impact of COVID and not just daily cases. But, you know, it's late in the game to be doing that. This is something we should have done a year ago.
A weekend of protesting amid some of the most famous landmarks in Paris. Having descended on the capital from all across France, these protesters had a strong message.
I got involved in this movement for our most fundamental rights, human rights. Today they are violated by vaccine passes, by laws that are completely liberticidal, and we can't let that happen.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks slumped further this week as investors decided to raise cash ahead of an extended three-day weekend in the U.S. Markets will remain closed on Monday in observance of President's Day, and many investors didn't want to be caught wrong-footed as tensions escalate between Russia and Ukraine. Of course, the biggest concern to the market and the global economy is not just the potential for war between NATO and Russian forces, that is a great power conflict between major world powers, but what this would do to oil and natural gas prices, which are already rising strongly. With inflation sitting at 40-year highs, this would put even more pressure on a Fed well behind the curve to raise rates even more aggressively. Put all this together and you have a second straight week of declines in the major averages and a strengthening risk-off environment for stocks. Hi everyone, I'm Chris Sheridan and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, the notable strategist Greg Weldon joins us today to discuss the massive surge in household debt levels in recent months. Greg says consumers are choking on inflation and taking on debt in order to pay for it. You'll definitely want to hear how he thinks this is all going to play out. Next, our CIO at Financial Sense Wealth Management joins us for another Smart Macro edition to give an update on the credit markets and what they are saying about the market outlook. Late last year, just as stocks were putting in their peak, Chris reiterated many times on our show, in alignment with what we were doing at our firm, investors may want to raise cash and get defensive because things were likely to get bumpy heading into this year. Well, that's obviously what we've seen, and Chris now says that the credit markets have unfortunately only deteriorated even further. Buckle up, because today's show is going to be a wild ride. Gene Munster is the founder and managing partner at Loop. And Gene, I want to start off with what you had mentioned late last year. You were talking about investors, particularly in big tech, being cautious headed into 2022. And I know that you were saying that you were really looking at the first 3 months of this year being a time for a correction. What is your outlook currently on the space?
We're getting closer, and we think about finding the bottom still over the next couple months, in part because we're still waiting for clarity from the Fed, and we're not at a point of clarity. And so I think that there still is downside risk here.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the big talk in the markets is inflation and what the Fed is going to do about it. How many times will they raise interest rates? Will it be 7, 6, 5, 4, or 2? And will they get that far? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Greg Weldon from Weldon Online. Greg, let's talk about where we are today. We're seeing inflation, and there's this talk, well, consumers can handle it. They've got a lot of money in the bank. They've been getting pay raises. But what I'm concerned about, Greg, is I'm seeing the discretionary stocks start to break down for the consumer. I just read in the Wall Street Journal that consumers took on $1 trillion of additional debt in 2021. So really, what kind of shape are consumers in, and what impact will that have on the economy?
Yeah, the numbers just came out. It's $1.124 trillion is the add-on to household debt in 2021. It rivals the numbers you saw in 2006 and 7 prior to the, you know, the subprime housing, burst. A lot of this is mortgages, but a lot of it's auto loans, Jim. And what's interesting about that, not to get off course, but since you bring it up right off the bat, you know, I just broke down these numbers the other day. When you look at auto loans, the growth in auto loans in the fourth quarter was almost as large as mortgages for the quarter. I mean, that's just unheard of, right? And while the amount of money being lent on auto loans is increasing very rapidly, the number of new loans is actually falling. And this is a function of inflation, Jim. So you talk about inflation, and I did a piece called the Kraken, and it's about how inflation, like the giant squid, gets its tentacles into everything, into every orifice of the ship, and basically into every orifice of the consumer, if you will. And to that degree, You see it in places that you don't really even realize it's there. And this is one of those places. Not only that, but subprime auto loans growing. So, and this is something the Fed has actually mentioned, the numbers in terms of, you know, delinquencies of everything are way down. I mean, foreclosures are virtually non-existent because of forbearance. Chicago Fed did a great study on this recently about the degree of forbearance, how it has impacted people, and what happens when it ends, all right, which, you know, not many people are even talking about. But interesting to note in that context, despite forbearance, the one place where delinquencies have actually, you know, started to turn to the upside are in the auto loan sector. Now, not as big as mortgages. It's a tenth of the size. So you're not talking about a 2007 type of accident, but you're talking about one of many smaller accidents that all could all get touched off at the same time and have a similar effect, primarily because, as you mentioned, the consumer discretionary sector has led the charge in the stock market. You put semiconductors up there first, but then you trickle down into really home builders and some things like that on the resource side, but really the consumer discretionary. And the degree to which that sector has rallied to new highs beyond anything even seen in 2019 kind of belies the fact that the consumer, all right, yeah, was flush with a lot of savings, was flush with a lot of free cash on hand, was flush with money from the government. But all of that is kind of now whittling down to where if you take the average wage gains, you're looking at the average, you know, median income person. All right, you know, half above, half below. You're talking about average, I should say, not median. Average income. The average person earning about $2,595 more in 2021 on a year-over-year basis than 2020. That amount of money was so rapidly eaten away by things that cost more because everything costs more. Food making new high in terms of inflation. Food at home leading the way there, which is unusual. And every time food at home has gotten above 6%, it's preceded a downturn in the economy, right? So what you have is all these people talk about how strong the consumer is, right? Savings on an annualized basis in the most recent quarter was down to $1.2 trillion. That's lower than it was before the pandemic. And you're talking coming down from a high of $6.6 trillion. So the savings is not what it was. Okay, number one, your income gain, your wages gain is being destroyed, vaporized immediately by inflation, all right? And the bottom line is consumers are telling the Fed, our gains and our wages eaten away, our savings have kind of been spent, and what are they doing? You have three of the five largest ever single month growth numbers for consumer credit in history. November was the single highest ever, almost $40 billion in a single month, which is twice the normal thing you would see in a peak period. All right. So three of the five largest in history have come in the last 7 months. Why? Because the savings is gone. The wage gains are being eaten up and consumers want to keep spending. They are borrowing to do it, Jim. And the bottom line, when you cut all of this away, there's one stat that really is all telling. The New York Fed household survey, and when you talk about people, they're saying they are better off now than they were 12 months ago and expect to be better off in 12 months versus those saying they're worse off now and expect to be worse off in 12 months. That has gone from 44% better off to 9% worse off as a ratio before the pandemic to 26% versus 26%. It's gone from basically a 4.5 to 1 positive ratio to flat. The number of people saying they expect to be worse off in 12 months has gone from 9.9% to 26.3%. All right. It hasn't gone down. It's still going up. And consumer cite inflation is the number one thing there. Consumers are choking at the lower end of the income scale. And, you know, Powell has left this longer policy in place to be more inclusionary in the labor market. And to some degree, it's worked. And by some stats, it hasn't worked. But the bottom line is, inflation is hurting those same people far more than anyone else. Sure, some people can afford to pay more for things. And the psychology here, Jim, underlying all of this is even bigger. And what that is, let alone the consumers that are telling the Fed in the Fed's own surveys that we're choking and inflation is number one thing, and we are much worse off than we were, all right, big percentage of the people in the economy, all right? And at the same time, you know how the psychological shift has gone from, you know, basically a decade or maybe even two decades of price discovery for consumers. Find the cheapest thing, get it delivered the next day. Amazon's been the star. Of course, Amazon's cracking as a stock. Two, that psychology is gone, okay? Because now it's about securing supply. All right, you know me, I'm a workout guy, but also, you know, I enjoy my sugar. So two of my kind of polarized things are, you know, Fage yogurt, which I eat first thing in the morning, you know, 60 grams of protein. And then I love the cookie dough, all right, in the afternoons when I have a sugar fix. I'm telling you, for the supermarkets here in Florida, neither one of those things has been available for the last couple of weeks. Neither is half and half for the coffee. All right. Consumers are much more focused on securing the supply of the things they want, and they don't care as much what they have to pay. That psychology creates pricing power. You read in the ISM numbers about the first wave of inflation you've had, about the second wave coming, because vendors have eaten those margins and they can no longer do that. So you're almost like setting up to see a second wave of price inflation that is still induced by, you know, supply and delivery chain dynamics that are not getting better that quickly. So, man, inflation is big. Inflation is choking the average Joe out there. The average Joe is screaming about it. And, you know, the Fed is getting ready to tighten monetary conditions. So go figure.
Well, let's talk about what the consensus is. I mean, the number of rate hikes are all over the map. You got Bank of America that thinks it's going to be 7. And the consensus is the Fed will start raising. And then we get into the second half of the year. The supply chain problems go away. Inflation moderates. And even though they're not calling it transitory, they're saying it's going to come down. Greg, I'm looking at the labor market. It is tight. You got the idiots in Washington talking about putting more stimulus, COVID stimulus, into the economy, that will get rid of inflation. And you've got oil prices, which are marching their way to $100 a barrel. We'll get into oil for a minute. So there are a lot of things down there that are telling me this thing's not inflation is not going to drop off a cliff and we're going to be back to normal by the end of the year. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I mean, I've said all along, and I mean, I've been saying this since the very beginning. I really am. I don't know of anyone that was, you know, immediately when the Fed immediately started using the word transitory, I was trashing that word, because transitory is a dangerous word. All right. Transitory would suggest prices of things are going to go up and prices of things are going to come back down. Prices of things are not coming back down, Jim. Everyone knows that. This inflation is permanent, permanent, not transitory, permanent. The exact opposite of transitory. Will the year-over-year rate come down? Of course it will at some point in time. That's what the Fed has been banking on this whole time. What I said early last year was the worst-case scenario for the Fed come the fourth quarter into the first quarter of this year would be if oil prices were still rising on a month-to-month basis, because then you push back this whole transitory narrative because the base effect isn't in play yet. All right? The way it stands now, the base effect for oil really isn't in play given the rally we see now until you get to like August or September. All right. So that's number one. Number two, the Fed is saying, okay, it's transitory, but we do expect inflation to kind of come back down to whatever degree. If you look at the Fed's Philadelphia survey recently, manufacturers in the Fed region are telling the Fed that they expect that consumers will pay 3.5% more for finished goods for the next 10 years. All right. Inflation expectations are blown out of the water. The Fed has been so myopically focused on keeping inflation expectations anchored, quote unquote. They are unanchored, man. It's anchors away on that one. And when all this ties together, you come back on the back end where you say, okay, inflation is transitory. It's come down to 2%. It's 2% on top of the 8% we have now, the 6% we probably have this year. You know, I mean, holy mackerel, Jim. Those are permanent price increases that people at the bottom end of the income scale cannot afford to pay. And that's why you're seeing borrowing through the roof. So it kind of comes all the way back around. Now, what's interesting to cycle back to the Fed and to cycle back to the expectations. All right. It wasn't even, you know, September of last year. It's only a matter of months ago where people were saying the Fed wasn't going to raise rates at all this year. All right. So the consensus can be damned as far as I'm concerned. The consensus has caught up to where the markets have been going for months. I mean, we got short the 2-year note as our big trade, you know, way early. I mean, it was still like it was below 30 basis points at the time, you know, 0.30 on a yield basis. Why? Because the Fed funds market was already pricing in a rate hike in 2022, was already pricing in maybe two more next year. So that's exploded. And that differential, you know, has to be closed. You can't have the 2-year note at basically 30 basis points where the 2-year Fed fund swap is at 1.25. All right. So that was one of the easiest trades of all time, is to be short the treasury market here. The problem for the Fed going forward is First of all, I don't think they'll get to all the rate hikes that are being priced in. All right. I think things will happen before that because of the tightening before we even get to seven hikes. Okay. The bigger question is, will the Fed potentially lose control of the bond market here when you're talking about, all right, public borrowing, the deficit, all right, but the means of financing the deficit, quote unquote, which is, you know, quote unquote, borrowing from the public, $2 trillion fiscal 2022, a record by far. And when you're talking about the Fed is going to withdraw $1.45 trillion annualized in support day by day, that's a problem, Jim. I mean, that's, you know, $3.5 to almost $4 trillion flip-flop, let alone interest rates are going up. So the interest expense on the debt's going higher. I mean, this is a real mess. And the Fed is kind of, you know, I mean, talk about walking the high wire across Niagara Falls with no safety net. I mean, that's kind of what Jerome Powell's tasked to do here. And I wouldn't want this job, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I want to come back to inflation for a moment. So we just saw a 7.5 print. I think we could get up to 8. But Greg, you and I know that the inflation numbers that you and I talk about in the news or what the media uses isn't the real rate. I mean, they use hedonics. You know, you take a look at the increase of a Ford 150. By the time you use hedonics, it didn't go up at all. Or you use substitution. If beef goes up, you eat fish. If fish goes up, you eat dog food. I mean, it's the numbers, I think the average person on the street, as you've been talking about, hitting the poor and the middle class, they're seeing higher numbers than what we're reporting.
Yeah, they are. And I'll tell you what, I have an anecdotal slice for that. You were out in California. My brother is part owner and head executive chef at Auberge du Soleil in Napa Valley, right? High class, you know, 5-star French restaurant. And I had a conversation with him recently, you know, how much more are you paying for your ingredients? All right. I mean, Jim, it starts at 25%. You know, that's the low end of the range of inflation, you know, for the food that my brother prepares, you know, in a high class restaurant. And I think that food to me is the biggest thing. We talk about this in terms of 7.5 in the US and the Federal Reserve. This is global, Jim. I'm going through the numbers right now. You go to places like in Eastern Europe, Lithuania, Latvia, Slovakia. I mean, inflation numbers in many of these places is double digits already. All right. It was a 12.4 print in Lithuania this morning. All right. This is global and it's food. And if you want to eat, you're paying more. And again, you've every single recession in the US has been preceded by a move in food away from home to a level above 6%. The only time that it didn't catch a recession was in the tech bubble of 2000, 2001. So that to me is a big indicator because you can't not eat. All right. And you're talking about, like you say, okay, the number might be 7.5, but you run down the number of things that are in double digits. If not for the lack of inflation in vegetables, I mean, everything else is going up. And it was 1.6% excluding bakery items for all food groups for the month of January. Think about that in an annualized rate, Jim. It's 20%. All right. So you can look at this a lot of ways. And again, you know, people are going to be ready to celebrate victory over inflation when the year-over-year rate kind of starts coming down, which it will. We know it will. It's a mathematical certainty. All right. That doesn't mean victory over inflation, Jim, because these prices will stick. Everything's going to cost more. And right now, wages are not coming up. Right now, all right. Right now, you have one of the deepest negative real wage numbers in the U.S. in history. I mean, like ever. You got to go back to, you know, world wars to find a negative, you know, 3% plus real average weekly earnings growth in the U.S. So it's a big problem, but it's also global, Jim. And that's what I don't think people realize. This is every nook and cranny of the world in a lot of places where people are much less able to afford price increases for food than we are here in the U.S.
Let's talk about oil for a minute, because the one thing that Fed cannot do, the Fed cannot create barrels of oil. The only thing they can do is kill economic growth and reduce demand. And you and I know, Greg, everything we buy in the store, whether you're going to the grocery store or, you know, going to the department store, it all got there by truck, diesel, boat, or something that's consuming energy. So this ramp up that we've seen in the price of oil, what are we, mid-90s now? That's going to be transferred. I mean, I just think of Amazon. You know, everybody's been ordering online. Well, what does Amazon do? They're delivering it with vans, trucks, planes, and things like that. I just think of what's happening to Amazon's cost of delivery.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting because we know we've spoken about this before, Jim. Climate change has nothing to do with saving the planet, all right? Because the changes in the planet are so significant that, you know, human beings are just not capable technologically of doing anything about it, all right? We know, and some places they've gone so far as to openly admit it, i.e. Europe and the European Commission and the ECB. Right, admitting that climate change is about the economy, Jim. It's about having an engine of global growth at a time when you need growth more than ever because there's more debt than ever. All right, and while trade is kind of chugging along right now, actually doing pretty good, all things considered, it's not the engine of global growth that used to be in percentage terms. So you need something new. So this is why they're so focused on, you know, wind and solar and all these alternative energies and all these things. It's all about GDP growth globally, Jim. It's really nothing about saving the planet because, frankly, we're so far behind the curve on that, and we're facing forces that involve, you know, tens of thousands of years of, you know, orbital cycles here in the, you know, in the Milky Way galaxy that are so far beyond us. NASA has already reclassified this. It's no longer global warming. Global warming does not exist anymore. All right, it's solar warming, officially, according to NASA. Why? Because the entire solar system is moving, all right, through the galaxy and in a place where, guess what? It gets warmer. And the bottom line is you got the, you know, the ice shelves on Pluto melting, right? Certainly not because we're driving SUVs, you know, that run on, you know, petroleum-based fuel here in the U.S. We said this almost 2 years ago, I think it was now. We spoke right after the Harvard-Yale football game, during which the students took, you know, the protest to the field at halftime, basically commandeered the field, commandeered the stadium, and demanded that the endowments, which are huge. I used to be a broker at Lehman. We used to have the Harvard Endowment Fund. I mean, they're massive. They move markets. Demanding that they, you know, disinvest from all the petroleum investments, right? So, of course, in one of the biggest, you know, oh, my God, everyone's going to front run the hell out of them moves. We said on this program, this thing around thinking you're going to get all these cars on the road, lithium batteries already, there's a whole new thing with the spike in lithium. You talk about cobalt and nickel. We've talked about this. There's not enough nickel produced in the world right now to support all these batteries. You're never going to get to where they say we want to get in the time frame they want to do it. It's just not feasible. And if you really just really look at any of the math, any of the backdrop, you know it's not feasible. So this just opened the door to where who's building new refineries, Jim? I mean, refinery, you know, refineries is a dirty business to the degree that you have to maintain the refinery. It's very expensive. All these companies, no one's investing. They have no capital. They're debt ridden. We said there would be gasoline shortages. We said on this program, you'd be looking at $7 to $10 a gallon in California. You're already there. You're talking about $5 to $6 here in the East Coast in the not too distant future. It's a one-way train. Will there be downside corrections based on supply dynamics if OPEC decides, you know, they're going to, you know, find some spare capacity somewhere? Sure, right? It's not a one-way train, but it's a one-way track. And, you know, so for me, that's the thing. You're buying, you know, you're buying gasoline on dips, and we recommended gasoline way back then, and, you know, it's like a dollar higher already.
Yeah, I see prices going higher, Greg. We had the companies themselves after 2014 stopped investing, and then you got ESG, you've got people getting seats on boards and having our big oil companies divest themselves of oil. I mean, I couldn't think of anything more stupid, but I want to come back to the issue of debt. We were talking about consumers adding $1 trillion. Greg, I think we ended the government's fiscal year in September. The debt was like 28.4 or 28.6. In 3 months, we added another $1.2 trillion. Growing at almost $400 billion a month. I mean, right now, the government pays close to 2% on most of its debt. If we see interest rates go up one full percentage point, Greg, that's another $300 billion in interest. So what's the Fed going to do when you have all these governments, whether it's ours or overseas in Europe, Canada, wherever you're looking at, these governments continue to issue more debt as these central banks want to pull back on the amount of monetization? What's going to happen?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you could kind of almost say it's, there's a variety of analogies I want to make here, but I mean, these are kind of two bullet trains headed right towards one another. I mean, because you can't have it both ways. You just can't. You have all this debt. And I would go so far as to say, if you tweak this a little bit in terms of the question, before we get to the answer to the actual question, is to ask, really, why has the Fed been so afraid to raise rates one freaking time from zero? You know, from an emergency rate for the last 2 years, we got the economy booming by every measure. You look at ISM, employment, you know, anything pretty much you could say the economy is booming. And the Fed is like tiptoeing through the tulips, which is one of our themes, you know, the Tiny Tim song, afraid to step on something. Why? Because they're still more afraid of a debt deflation, Jim. And, you know, and Powell has told us he's a champion of Paul Volcker, and he feels he can defeat inflation. Doesn't matter if it gets high. The question is, what, you know, defeat inflation, what, the way Paul Volcker did? By taking interest rates, you know, you want to take the 2-year note up to 6, 7, 8%.
Good luck.
I mean, it would crush the economy, and you'd unleash the exact problem you're trying to avoid. So this is the conundrum for the Fed. I mean, you know, walking too aggressively through the tulip bulb field, all right, and stepping on something that unleashes an asset price deflation that brings about a debt deflation. And therein lies the big problem. When you're talking about, again, growth, you need growth to service all this debt. If you don't, it's a house of cards and will collapse in on itself. I liken it how many times to a black hole, where basically once you're kind of past the event horizon, you can't get out because the energy sucks you in. I would say globally, in terms of a debt black hole, we're already past the event horizon. There's no escaping it, you know, and this is why they've chosen, you know, to err on the side of easiness again and again and again. The question becomes mathematics, becomes geometry. Look at the stock market in the US, look at the NASDAQ. The angle of ascent in the stock market, the angle of ascent in debt held by the government, public debt, the angle of ascent of the Fed's balance sheet, these are not sustainable, let alone the numbers. When nominally you're speaking about this as a 50-year bubble, right? This is not since 2009. 2009 was one of the downturns. We printed more money. Now we had 2020 downturn. We printed more money. Exponentially every time we have to print more money to get the same impact, to keep this thing floating, to avoid a complete collapse. So they will always do what they have to do. The question is, you know, at what point does it not work anymore? And that's the big fear going forward, that you're one step closer to the time, if not next time, that this all doesn't work. You can't just keep papering this thing over. The building is so tall, you know, the paper is not going to hold it up anymore, especially when the wind starts blowing. And inflation is that wind right now.
Yeah, because you take a look at what did it take them 5 years to raise the Fed funds rate to 2.5, and the minute that the markets hiccuped and the economy started to slow down, they went to zero again. So, Greg, how can they walk this high wire? I mean, you take a look at corporate debt, consumer debt, government debt. Realistically, they've got to be sitting there. He's got to be, you know, quite honestly, scared as hell. If they overdo this, they could crush the economy. Then how are they going to revive it? I mean, are they going to expand and triple their balance sheet?
Yeah. And I mean, it's almost like they needed to do this faster so they would have some ammunition should you get a downturn. Because the longer they wait, I think the more weight inflation puts on the consumer. It's almost like, I mean, either they're kind of sitting there praying they don't have to raise rates that much, that the economy will downturn, take some of the steam out of inflation, and they'll be like, okay, we take it back to 1% and we're fine. As opposed to, you know, guess what? Inflation runs away, but the economy turns down. Then what are you going to do? I mean, it really is a big, you know, a big question mark. You know, I would say that, you know, just gosh, in terms of all this happening, the stock markets are at risk here. You know that I recently did a speech just literally a week ago. We made it available on my YouTube channel for anyone who wants to see it, just as a plug there. But it's called Sock Puppet Strategies. And it's a follow-up to the speech I did in 2020 called Age of Aquarius, when I said increased volatility and everything would come. You would see higher inflation, all the things that have happened. All right. The next stage of this is potentially, you know, the inflation becomes negative for asset prices if the Fed, you know, responds too aggressively. You know, we are either Argentina, where this inflation is the greatest thing for the equity market. I don't see it that way right now. But watch gold and watch the gold's relationship with the dollar here, Jim, because I think that gold looks perky and I think gold is about to respond to all the money printed. I just did a special on the precious metals too. All right. But not to get too far ahead of myself. I mean, Sock Puppet Strategies basically goes back to the bubble in 2000. Right. What was the big thing back then? Right. All you had to do was get an internet site. Okay. All you needed was .com. And you could go public and make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars without even really having a product or a business or services or anything. Pets.com was the epitome of that. All right. They had the sock puppet, if you remember. Every celebrity wanted to be in commercials with the sock puppet. The sock puppet was the big thing in the 2000 Super Bowl. Right. But, you know, within months, the sock puppet, pets.com, all of it was gone. It was worthless. Right. Because it was worthless to begin with. We have sock puppets out there. Doge, Shiba, those are today's sock puppets, all right? People hoping to build fortunes on something that really doesn't even exist. It's not of any value whatsoever. That's number one, all right? That degree of delusion, if you will, all right, that these are real things that can carry you for the next 20 years and create wealth for you is ridiculous, or it really is. I'm sorry. That's not to diss Bitcoin. We actually like Bitcoin here, like we like gold. But to circle all the way back to, in terms of the special, what you have to look at right now, Jim, is that gold is acting in a way that we haven't seen in a while because, you know, it really hasn't broken out. And people have said, why is gold languishing? And it's like, well, gold is held like a rock star. It's held the 50% retracement. It's held the two-year moving average. It is held everywhere it's needed to hold. It hasn't cracked at all. And in fact, now, all right, even with the dollar not declining, gold is starting to go up against every paper currency on the planet. That's huge. And that's a reflection of what we've seen in all this money printing, all this debt printing, and whether it's the consumer, whether it's households, whether it's governments, it's at new highs, not only nominally in the amount of debt, but also in the 12-month creation of that debt. And it's everywhere. It's globally. So to me, you start looking at this whole thing around paper assets versus stuff. It's that simple. It's the old argument. It's the old Jim Grant, you know, pyramid. Where, you know, you come down to it and it's like, you just keep printing trillions and trillions of dollars every time this happens. At some point, people look around, they don't want to hold something that's, you know, denominated in a paper IOU.
You know, if you would told me, Greg, 2 years ago, we would see 7.5-8% inflation in 2-year treasury yields, I would have said you're nuts. But that's where we have. We have, what, the 2-year note is approaching 2%. It's been above it recently. You've got inflation close to 8%. And some people say, why hasn't gold gone higher given these dynamics, the amount of debt, the inflation that's been rising, rising oil prices? What's your take on that?
Well, it's actually really kind of interesting because what if I threw you a curveball here, Jim?
Okay.
All right. I would say that, yeah, you know, inflation's gone up. And the Fed hasn't responded. And this, you know, gold really hasn't rallied. I mean, you know, shouldn't this be bad for stocks and this, that, and the other thing? And it's kind of almost like, why is gold not broken out? Why hasn't the stock market broken down? One of the things that I can criticize myself for not giving enough credit at first, too, was the thought process that as inflation is rising, Jim, and as the 2-year treasury note is not moving, it's hitting record all-time lows in negative territory on a real basis. From the perspective that, you know, even up until just the last week or two, the Fed's still pumping in like $4 billion a day. Money supply is still growing by basically $5 to $10 billion a day. All right. Mm. So why is the stock market not kind of coming off? It's like, okay, well, because it's still really, really loose monetary conditions. And I said to a lot of people here, and again, it was like an interesting comment. What happens if this whole thing starts kind of rolling in the treasury market? When inflation turns down, and what happens if that causes real, you know, bond yields to start to rise, that actually then cripples the stock market, which would be your catalyst for moving to gold. So that's kind of the way I see it playing out. Let's see if, you know, you can't really turn this whole thing upside down on its head and say when inflation rolls over, that's the time to really be wary of the stock market. And that's the time you may actually want to be really make sure you own gold.
Well, you know, it's I call this the asset bubble everywhere. Greg, I'm looking at a frame that I have in my study. It's a front cover of Bloomberg from, I think it's 2018, 2019. It's got a fallen dinosaur, and it says, is inflation dead? And it reminds me of the Business Week. You remember the 1979, stock market or the equity market's dead? And so as I look at this kind of stuff that's happening right now, the perceptions and the way the markets have been so distorted by these asset bubbles. I mean, I'm looking at P.E. ratios. I don't care if you're looking at consumer staples. You're looking at a Coca-Cola. It's at almost 30 times earnings. Procter & Gamble, almost 30. You've got valuations that we haven't seen since the internet bubble.
This is the most extended and stretched market I've seen in my 4 decades of doing this. And you know me, Jim, for a long time. You know I'm a really humble guy, right? I don't like to be self-promotional. But I can tell you this, all right? I made a ton of money in 87, being short the stock market. All right. I went on, the first time I ever went on TV was on FNN in 1990.
Oh, you're right, dating yourself, dude.
I know, but I was working for Howie Levine. I don't know if you know that name, but legendary New York broker, right? And he used to go on TV all the time. And he was on vacation. The station called, and they asked me if I would go on. And I was just, you know, like my own little broker there working under his umbrella at the time. And I said, sure. And I had done all my homework over the weekend. It was a Monday morning. I went on. I said, you know, I think you're 35 to 40% down on this stock market. Remember, 1991 came in through the Gulf War and everything, but it was a big recession. It really was hurtful, right? And it's the first time the Greenspan cut rates to 3% when inflation was 3%, taking a, you know, real rates to zero for the first time ever. And people went bananas over that, right? It was just the beginning. And people were looking at it like this is Armageddon, monetary Armageddon. But the point is, I called the decline in the stock market. I get back to the office and I get called upstairs to the executive office to the president, right? It was Shearson Lehman Brothers, American Express at the time. Well, they had, it was just right around this time of year, and they had run a big weekend advertising campaign on NFL football for, you know, for Shearson Lehman Brothers with Elaine Garzarelli, if you remember who that was.
Oh, famous, sure.
A prognosticator back in the day, about being bullish the stock market. And the very next morning, one of the first interviews on FNN was this guy from Shearson Lehman saying stock market is going down 35 to 40%. They were pissed. I almost lost my job. The fact was I was right. All right. 2000. I'm a regular on the show called The View, the original View, not the one that's popular now, with Ted David. All right. I had just been doing my homework that day. We usually didn't talk stocks. We talk currencies and commodities a lot. And I was on every Wednesday night. And I come on and I just happened to do my homework. The NASDAQ had a big down day. It had just come off its all-time high and was still at 5,400. All right. He asked me, and again, totally caught me off guard, well, how low do you think the NASDAQ can go? And I just gave him my answer without really thinking. All right. We're at 5,400. I blurred out on national TV. I think it's going to 1,300. All right. We were on the high chairs, right? And Ted Davis is not a small guy. And I swear he almost toppled over on his chair. I was never asked back on the show. And I emailed him 8 months later when we were at 1,300. Okay. I called the 2008-9 debacle in my book. And I called the 2020 downturn, which is pretty easy to call, in my speech. I'm good at calling these kinds of moves in the stock market. And this is the most exposed and vulnerable and stretched market I've ever seen. I call it the Wile E. Coyote market. This is the wrap up you got on, Jim, right? Because it really is the roadrunner and the coyote. All right. The coyote's chasing the roadrunner around. The roadrunner outsmarts them every time. The coyote's the stock market. And in this case, you know, the coyote has run off the cliff. His feet are still going. He doesn't realize yet that he's run off the cliff and he's about to look down and realize his fate. To me, that's kind of like the stock market, living on borrowed time here, Jim.
So if you were an investor, given this, I mean, we own oil, we're in commodities, base metals, we have some defensives. What would you be doing as an investor here from what you see?
Well, again, with all humility, I'd be taking every dollar of risk capital only from qualified investors, and calling Greg Weldon, CTA, and looking to get involved in all these things, because this is what we do. It's difficult, Jim. You know, I'm a futures market guy. I really love the futures market. I think everyone should take, you know, advantage of the futures markets. But the biggest mistake is people are undercapitalized. These contracts are huge. The swings are significant. You know, we have a $1 million minimum in our CTA, and people are like, oh, you just want to raise more money and increase the fees. And it's like, no, man. You know, right now we bought gold. All right. The risk was $44. All right. That's not a big deal when you're $2,000 an ounce, but that's $4,400. All right. My risk parameters are 0.4% per trade. That means I can do one contract of gold only if I have $1 million under management. So re-engineering this stuff backwards. So my point is, it's difficult to do it. I think if you want to do it, it's really, you want to kind of do it yourself or find someone you trust to do it, you know, with you / for you. All right. You know that we're managed accounts only. We don't, you know, commingle money. People get full transparency every day. A report. What are we in? What are we not? What's the cash? What's the profits? What's the losses? I mean, it's full transparency. The only way I can do this and be credible is to be 100% transparent. And if someone doesn't like what we're doing, we have no lockup period. But you need to be in and out, you know, to the degree that you have flexibility to be long and short. And in everything, being short bonds has been a huge trade. Being long some of the commodities like cotton, like coffee, have been huge trades. These are opportunities that are out there that you can't always take advantage of in the stock market. And if buy and hold is going to go on, you know, a holiday for a while, it's going to make the stock market a very treacherous place to be. So I think investors would really behoove themselves to best take advantage of what's coming next by kind of, you know, being more diversified and being willing to take, you know, some risk with risk capital only, and doing some things that are not necessarily, you know, what you would call in the norm. But why not? I mean, math is math, risk is risk, and you can manage it just as well in the commodities and currency and bond markets as you can in the stock market. And that's what we do here at Weldon Financial every day.
Well, Greg, I mean, let me throw just a couple more questions and then we'll conclude here. And one is geopolitics. You referred to this, what's going on in the South China Sea. China's getting aggressive, flybys, Taiwan testing their defenses. We've got Russian troops on the Ukraine. But right now, the number one concern of Americans is what we've been talking about in this program today, and that's inflation. So put yourself in Jerome Powell's shoes and put yourself in the Biden administration's shoes. It comes to November. Inflation is still soaring. We're looking at $6, $7 gasoline. The Fed is raising interest rates. Real estate prices are falling. The stock market is collapsing. The economy is slowing down. What would you be asking the Fed to do? You know, I think of back when Trump, remember when Trump put his tax bill through and Jerome Powell was raising interest rates and Trump's trying to stimulate the economy with tax cuts. And he said, what the hell are you doing? What do you think is going to happen?
I don't think there's an answer to that question I can give you that, you know, satisfies me. So if that's the way it is, then that's not a good sign. I really think it's kind of, you know, I don't think that they can protect investors the way they've been able to in the past. I think that's the biggest takeaway, that the Fed is very slowly losing credibility and frankly losing some degree of their power. That's not to say they couldn't come up with something unbelievable. I mean, they pulled the rabbit out of their sleeve many, many times. You know, I didn't think a rabbit would fit up there, but they keep pulling one out of their sleeve, not out of the hat, out of their sleeve. And that, you know, that rabbit is, you know, new ways to create money. All right. We've talked in the book, even way back in 2006, I talked about the ultimate path to this leads to monetary Armageddon, which is where you're in the bunker, right? And you have the general, which would be Powell, and you have the treasury guy, and they both have to put the keys in and simultaneously turn it to vaporize every debt piece of paper, treasury bond ever issued, sold, or created. Just wipe it all clean. All right. Doesn't matter that a loaf of bread will cost $50. Okay, because they will have printed trillions of more dollars. So, you know, I just see this as a long trend that will kind of continue to play out. But, you know, my futuristic view really goes along two different paths. One is a spiritual evolution path of enlightenment among our species. All right. The other path is a more realistic earthy path that is some combination of Terminator and Mad Max, Jim. All right. I don't necessarily think we'll see that in our lifetimes. I worry for my grandkids.
The insane thing about all of this, the debt is growing at $400 billion a month. They're talking about another stimulus bill.
They'll keep doing it, Jim. They'll just keep doing it. I mean, because they MMT is basically the new creation, the new elixir of, you know, monetary magic that's going to, you know, absolve them of their sins, so to speak, not to make it, you know, that severe. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, I just think, it just, at this point, you're at the point where it doesn't matter because it's gone too far. And it, you know, it really is kind of a house of cards that could blow over at any time. I mean, take a dollar. I mean, you know, I mean, talk about like taxes and stuff, Jim. I mean, you know, you take a dollar. I actually did, when I did my speech, I had this little, some graphics where the dollar is like in an abusive relationship. It's like, how come the police are not coming to rescue the dollar? The dollar is being abused by the Treasury and the Fed, printing trillions of them and then putting it out there. And it taxed, you know, it's taxed when I earn it. It's taxed. I pay sales tax when I buy something. The guy who sold me something pays tax. Then he puts it in the bank to leave for his kids when he dies. And then they come in and tax it again. I mean, think about it. Every dollar that's created is trillions and trillions of dollars and more taxes they can, you know, they can take in too. So the whole thing is just this gigantic hot air bubble. And you know that all these systems are doomed to failure. How this plays out, to me, ties into some of the science, Jim, because the things that you mentioned about human behavior are all part of this. We could get really deep and heavy, probably too heavy for most people to want to even think about. When you start to talk about the 25,800-year cycle of the solar system's orbit through the Milky Way and where we are right now, two things happen physically to this planet. Number one, the atoms in a given space are becoming less and less. That's the Gauss readings, all right? And I'm simplifying this, but that's the basic gist of it. At the same time, all right, because where we are now in the galaxy is a much lighter area. Talk about enlightenment. There's a reason they say that, because actually the most light from all other sources, supernovas, pulsars, you know, variety, you know, there's all kinds of things in terms of star clusters and things in this part of the galaxy versus where we just came, which was very dormant. All right. All that light hits the planet, right? And it has an impact on the, you know, on the atomic dynamic in on this planet. Number one, less atoms in a given space. Number two, the Schumann resonance index, which measures basically the geomagnetic electricity on the planet, is rising and through the roof, Jim. All right. You have record number of active earthquake, of active volcanoes right now on this planet, 29. All right. Most of them along the Ring of Fire. When you look at some of the things around the physics and the geology of the planet, you see it. But it also applies to human beings, because what you have, but based on the science, all right, the Schumann and the Gauss means one thing in two parts. All right. The intensity of the volatility and the vibrations on this planet are rising. Number one. And number two, everything is polarized more and more by the same dynamic. And each end of the spectrum is vibrating more rapidly, more frequently at a, you know, a higher rate. You see it in the extremism on the left of the political scale and the extremism on the right of the political scale. It's not that it's warmer, although it is. It's also record heat and record cold. It's record drought, record floods. It's record everything. This is a cycle that is early stage and only going to get worse. So when you talk about what's in the future, you have to consider that the destabilization is taking place everywhere. It is at the core of the scientific dynamic on this planet, and it extends to the markets, it extends to human behavior, it extends to the environment, it extends to the weather, it extends to everything. And to me, that's why you've turned a corner to where the things that have worked in the past in terms of printing money and papering this thing over are not going to work, because it's the lower end of the income scale that gets hurt the most by inflation. They're getting left behind. When you even look at now the new mortgages being created, a higher proportion than ever are with people with the highest credit scores, okay? Leaving those with the lower credit scores in the dust to try and buy a home, let alone prices going up. Now interest rates are going up and all this dynamic, all right? There will come a time, you already see it in terms of this entitlement dynamic among kind of the youth too, where guess what? You know, you can't exist on $20 an hour, 40-hour work week in this environment. Nobody can, right? So that kind of puts everyone on the lower part of the income scale, makes them more tense. And as the science continues to get more volatile, those people will become more volatile. And that's where you start to look. The next time you have a recession, the chance for, you know, some kind of social unrest goes through the roof, Jim. So all these things are things we have, you know, in our future. And that's why I think it's time now to take advantage of some of the opportunities to create some wealth, you know, while it kind of still almost matters, to where, you know, maybe you can be better prepared for what's coming next.
Well, I'll tell you, you're not alone, Greg, because Ray Dalio, in his new book about cycles of empires, rise and fall, talks about, I think we're at the 80% level where you either talk about revolution or upheaval. And that's exactly what it, when you starve people, when people can't afford to buy gas. I mean, I just think of, you know, all the people around here that are just doing domestic service stuff. The guy that does your pool, the guy that does your lawn, he's got to buy gasoline, and now he's not going to be able to buy a gas mower in California. So what does he do? So this really starts to impact people. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, tell people about Weldon Online, and also I'm going to recommend you bring up the book that you wrote about the Gold Boot Camp, one of the best books on gold I've ever written.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I mean, Gold Boot Camp's like ancient now, but we still sell the damn thing, which is mind-blowing. But yeah, wrote it in 2006, hardest thing I ever did. Basically lays out my whole kind of, you know, the way I look at the markets philosophically, and then gave this kind of the early part of this whole, you know, secular thing that we're talking about, that, you know, if you want to talk about the markets here in the U.S., link back to 71, we went off the gold standard. That gave the dollar the right of seniorage and the ability to print as much as you want. We see that in spades now. So that's the book. I recently did the speech, which is available on YouTube, called Sock Puppet Strategies. We just finished an 80-page special on precious metals with all my top picks In the gold mining, silver mining, you know, in the sector. So that's be available. Also, if you hit on the YouTube channel, you'll find that as well. But really, the core of our business is twofold. You know, we do research. It's broad-based. It covers all these markets, all the stuff we're talking about here, and it has recommendations in all the markets, fixed income, foreign exchange, the whole range of commodities, ETFs, you know, the stock market in terms of sectors and stuff like that. You know, it goes out to a lot of the big institutions. Some of the biggest traders in the world are my customers, but so are, you know, retired individuals. So it really runs the gamut there. And then we do run a very held, tightly held CTA. I don't normally even talk about it, but I think the opportunities are such now that, you know, that we, you know, we can help protect people and we can help people withstand what's coming in terms of inflation and have more money to kind of meet the increasing demands that you're going to have to spend your money on things that you need. So that's the CTA. All of that can be found at WeldonOnline.com.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best. Stay healthy and we'll talk again.
We do have this view that the gold and silver prices probably will rise sharply. And that's predicated on the idea that we'll have a very hostile economic and political environment. And, you know, there are people who will tell you that we're in a hostile economic and political environment right now. And my response is, it's going to get a lot worse.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us for another Smart Macro edition is Chris Poplava, CIO of Financial Sense Wealth Management. And Chris, when we spoke with you late last year, you had discussed how the credit markets were deteriorating. There was a large cluster of Hindenburg omens that we had now seen across most of the major indices starting in November. And for those reasons and others, you are warning our listeners and investors that it may be a good idea to get more defensive, raise some cash heading into what you expected to be a very bumpy 2022. If you would mind, give us an update on where things stand today.
Well, you know, unfortunately, no good news. Essentially, when I'm looking at the credit markets, I'm seeing junk bond spreads deteriorating further. If I look at credit default swaps on junk bonds and on investment grade debt, those also are continuing to rise. So no all clear. And another thing I take a look at are some really risky structured debt. And they're a good barometer for market liquidity. And I'm starting to see some of these structured notes. There's one in particular that I look at issued by Goldman Sachs. About, you know, a week and a half ago, it was trading at 98 cents on the dollar. Today, it's at 87. So it's been dropping pretty precipitously. And I don't see any significant turnaround there yet. So I definitely think we've got a risk-averse environment. Liquidity is drying up in the riskiest areas. People are getting defensive. Credit spreads are still widening. So unfortunately, I don't think we're through this. And I think, if anything, the rally that we saw late January into early February was more of a pause or a dead cat bounce. We failed to get above some key moving averages. For the S&P, we failed to get above the 50-day. So we're still below the intermediate term trend. If you look at other indices, they're below their 200-day and 50-day moving averages. So I think the path of least resistance remains down.
Yeah, and if you look at oil prices, we're now above $90. I think we got to a high of, gosh, it looks like 95. We've pulled back from there just slightly. But oil prices are firming on the geopolitical tension. Gold has also been doing fairly well, been getting a lift based on some of the tensions that we see. What are some of the other things that you're looking at? And I do want to draw our listeners' attention to your weekly investment video that we posted on Monday, talking about how the market appears now to be pricing in recession risks.
One of the things I was commenting on was we've seen the last couple of weeks a huge surge in sovereign bond yields, and to a lesser extent, also a rise in the U.S. yields. But what I want to point out, typically interest rates rise either due to rising inflation or rising economic growth rates. And what I'm drawing the attention to in the presentation on Monday was it's not due to inflation expectations and also I believe the rise is not due to accelerating economic growth. In fact, we have decelerating economic growth. If you look at the U.S. ISM manufacturing PMI, that peaked in the spring of last year in the mid to high 60s. We're now below that at 57.6. If you look at the U.K., they peaked at around 66 on their PMI in June of last year. We are below 60, and we've been trending down. You look at the Eurozone, that's been trending down since the middle of last year. And so pretty much every region has been trending down. So the rise in real interest rates is not due to rising market-based inflation expectations, and it's not due to rising economic growth. It's due to something else. And in my opinion, what I tried to articulate was I think it's due to central banks beginning to step back. One of the slides that I showed was looking at the U.S. Treasury's net issuance of debt less central bank buying. And what was astounding is we increased our federal debt outstanding from, I believe, roughly $22 trillion to $30 trillion since the pandemic. And what is amazing is that since late 2020 through the third quarter of last year, the net treasury issuance was flat, essentially meaning central banks were buying all of the net treasury issuance that was being issued. So we didn't really see a rise in net treasury issuance because central banks were buying. However, we started to see the Fed begin to taper late last year, carrying into this year. And as the Fed began to slow its purchases, and even if you look at foreign banks like the Bank of England, they've been tapering for a while now and already raising interest rates, we are starting to see net issuance of treasury debt less central bank buying breaking out to new highs, and that is pushing interest rates higher. So essentially, with the global economy coming back from unprecedented stimulus, we're seeing central banks slowing their purchases. The question is, who's going to buy all this government debt? And the answer is, you know, investors, but they're going to want to be compensated for that in the form of higher yields. So when we look at what the market is expecting in terms of central bank tightening, this really is the bookend of what we saw in 2020. And in 2020, every central bank was cutting rates, they were printing money, and we look at where we are today, and we've got a lot of tightening being priced into the markets. If you look at where we are for the U.S., the market's pricing in interest rates rising by the federal funds rate by 1.76%. In Canada, also nearly a 2% increase in their central bank rate. Mexico looks almost around 2.5% bump in their rate. And you look in the Eurozone, roughly 0.75%. United Kingdom, almost a 2% rate increase in their funding rate. You look at Norway, over 1%. And you look in Australia, 1.5%, New Zealand, 2%. I mean, on and on. There's not a single central bank out there that's cutting rates. They're all raising rates. And so with central banks getting aggressive in tightening to combat this massive increase in global inflation, they're stepping away. And yet we still have rampant fiscal spending that hasn't been curtailed from 2020 levels.
So, Chris, as you pointed out, we're seeing a global spike in bond yields. And of course, this is going to have direct impacts on the global economy. I mean, if we think about just debt levels as high as they are, there's a lot of leverage in the system. Tell us about some of the downstream impacts that you think can come from this.
Well, if you look at where the 10-year Treasury is today on the day you and I are speaking, it's at 1.92%, briefly being over 2% over last week. Now, the market is pricing in 7 rate hikes over the next year. So 7 rate hikes implies a federal funds rate of about 1.5%, possibly higher, maybe 1.75% as we get into the early part of next year. And if the 10-year is still sitting at 2% and we're getting above 1.5%, that's a real compression in the yield curve. And if we have an inverted yield curve, that's going to raise the recession alarm bells. We almost always see the yield curve invert. And inversion is where short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. And when we see that, it's unprofitable for banks to lend. They borrow on the short end and they lend on the long end. And so no bank would lend at a lower rate than their borrowing costs. And so credit begins to dry up, and that ultimately leads into a recession. And that's the concern I have. And what I was pointing out is if you look at the yield curve here in the U.S., it is dramatically flattened to roughly 40 basis points if you just look at the difference between a 10 and 2-year treasury. So that's not a lot of difference between short and long-term rates. And this is not just in the U.S., this is globally. What is astounding, and I hadn't looked at this in a while, but if you look at yield curves across the pond in the U.K., they're only 8 basis points away from an inverted yield curve. If you look at the U.S., as I mentioned, we're around 40 basis points. That's also where the Canadian government is. And if you look at Europe, Australia, you're seeing a flattening of yield curves across the board. So if we see aggressive short-term tightening by central banks, and if long-term rates don't move up materially because economic growth is slowing, if they stay roughly where they are, we may be staring at multiple inverted yield curves across the board, you know, looking out across other countries later this year.
I did share a chart with you. This is from one of our guests that we have on our show, Nick Reese. He had pointed out that 2-year forward 2-10s just inverted this week. And he points out the last two times that has happened, we saw a recession about 21 months later. So at this point, with the current inversion that we've seen, that would project we could be looking at another recession around November 2023.
That would definitely be the concern. I mean, you know, this is a risky environment and why we remain defensive, because typically the Fed raises into an accelerating economy, trying to slow it down. We already have a growth slowdown. They're not trying to slow the economy down. They're trying to slow overall inflation, which effectively, does involve slowing the economy. But typically when the Fed raises rates, economic growth is accelerating still. So you have rising corporate earnings, rising retail sales. The economy can absorb that shock. When you tighten into a slowdown, that is when the economy and the markets have trouble. It's kind of like Laxmanakhithan from Economic Cycle Research Institute. He always points out that when the economies are accelerating, we can absorb shocks, whether it be a commodity price spike, you know, some kind of vulnerability, a geopolitical shock, an economic shock. Growth does a great job of acting as a shock absorber. However, when growth is flat or slightly negative, that is when you are vulnerable. It's like when you're down and getting kicked when you're down. A good example of that was we had housing during the housing crisis imploding. The economy was still holding up. We were still adding jobs, but at a slower pace. But then we were starting to roll over. And then in 2008, in February, then we had Bear Stearns blow up. So that was a shock in a weak environment that just kind of cascaded into a series of unfortunate events. And so the risk that we have is we have economies that are slowing. We're still strong, but we are slowing. And in the face of that, we have very aggressive central bank tightening ahead of us, at least priced by the markets. We've got the Russian-Ukraine tensions going on. And at the same time, we've got central banks stepping back while overall government debt issuance is at record levels. So this is a lot for the market to contend with. Why remain defensive? And it could be that for central banks to kind of ease up on their projected path of rate hikes, we need to see some market weakness. Now, if you go back into 2018, the market fell 20% and then the Fed responded and we had the Powell pivot. We had roughly a 17-18% correction in 2015 going into 2016. And we had the Janet Yellen pivot, where Janet Yellen was going to raise rates 4 times in 2016. She ended up only doing it once. So, but back then, you know, the concern is we didn't have inflation at over 7-8%. Or goods inflation in double-digit territory. We have that case now. So the put level for the Fed in terms of the market may actually be lower than where we were back then. Because again, the Fed has to fight inflation. It has a lot of pressure from the government to do so. So I think that's why the markets are vulnerable and why even with the decline that we've seen already, we still think there's more to come.
Yeah, and it appears that Felix Zuloff's outlook is playing out so far as he expected when we spoke with them late last year about a medium-term peak in the market. And then he was expecting anywhere from, I believe, a 20 to 30% correction this year in 2022 before the Fed finally does flip-flop or pare back on the number of expected rate hikes. And then we see a resumption of the bull market higher up into that 2024 time frame. And it seems like, you know, with the 2-year Ford 210s, like we discussed, inverting, you know, that could even be pushed off into 2024. That is aligning with Felix Zuloff's outlook and sort of what we're seeing with the credit markets currently. Any thoughts on that?
I think he's got it right. You know, again, we've got decelerating economies, central banks are tightening. We haven't had that pivot, you know, whether it's the Janet Yellen pivot, the Powell pivot, we haven't had it yet. And so I still think that we are in that window of vulnerability and cash is king. You're going to want to be defensive. This could be a case where we have bond yields and stock prices fall, where basically bond prices and stock prices fall. And so even a balanced portfolio may not save you. I think, again, cash is king. And what we are looking for is the credit markets to kind of give us the all clear sign. And we don't see that yet. So until we do, we don't feel like jumping in blindly. And we'll wait for the market to stabilize and bottom.
So, Chris, as we mentioned 2 weeks ago, since spring of last year, we moved to an overweight in the energy sector, given our bullish outlook for oil. That has played out, and we still think that there's probably some upside ahead. We are underweight bonds. We're underweight the stock market more broadly, sitting on cash, waiting to deploy that. And I want to remind all of you listeners to make sure you watch each of our weekly updates that we do. Check those out on our website, on our video page, or on YouTube. Chris, with that said, I want to thank you for coming on again for another segment of Smart Macro. We will speak to you in another 2 weeks.
Sounds great, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.